take session number 11721, reel 1.
Mr. Bourne, reel 1. How did you come to be on motor torpedo boats, please?
When I joined the Navy in 1939, I had ambitions to get a commission. And in doing so, I joined the Fleet Air Arm. That lasted overlong, but not too successfully. And I went back into general service and then opted to go into motor torpedo boats.
What was your interest in it?
In torpedo boats?
Yes.
Well, it was a chance to have one's own command, even if you were, a member of a flotilla. At some stage, one might even advance to the flotilla leader. It offered a fair amount of excitement. You mix with characters generally of one's own standing, and not that that had any much to do with it, but you were with people that were thinking and had the same end view in mind. That's one of the reasons why I decided to go into torpedo boats. I got to motor launches to start with. That was my first ingress into it. And then went from there into torpedo boats.
This was in 1941, was it?
I think it was about then. I think it was approximately then, yes. I got my commission actually in, I think, July 41, I think it was. And I then went from there into torpedo boats.
What kind of special training did you have to have for MTBs?
Well, we did a torpedo course. Apart from general seamanship, which I'd, one picked up previously. I mean, I had been an able seaman on a destroyer for a while, and one knew the general naval routine. But specialised in torpedo boats, I did a course up at Fort William, specifically for MTBs, and a torpedo course at Road Inn at Wrighton. Having qualified in both of those, I was then given a boat to command.
Which was that?
My first MTB was 344.
And was it part of a flotilla?
Well, yes and no. She was actually, she had torpedo tubes on her, but the army, in the shape of an organisation called SSRF, Small Scale Raiding Force, had got their eyes on her. And Roger Thornycroft of Thornycroft Company, whom I knew, and I was waiting for a boat at that stage, said, "Would I like to take over 344? And I said, "Yes." And then he pointed out that the army were going to take her over. Was I still interested? And I said, "Yes," because previously I had done some naval intelligence work on A boats, and I said, "Yes, I'm game to get a boat and operate like that." And we proceeded from there. They took the tubes off and they refurbished her with commando dories, and we went on operations in that way. And I did that for nearly a year, I think it was.
Where were you based when you were doing that work?
Well, my home base was Portsmouth, Gosport, but it depended where we were going to raid the French coast as to which base I sailed from. If we were going, shall we say, west of the French coast, down the Roche d'Ouvre or somewhere like that, I'd sail from Portsmouth to Dartmouth, re-equip in Dartmouth, and then pick the army up there and take them across from Dartmouth, or maybe New Haven, it might have been, or from Portsmouth, or Portland. Any base which they wanted to operate from, I joined them there.
Can you give more details about the character of the work that you were doing?
Yes. The army group I was dealing with were a specialist force, under Major March Phillips and a chap called Geoffrey Appleyard, and they were both eventually quite famous army commandos. They had an establishment at Anderson Manor at Bear Regis, where they had this sort of small commando group headquarters. I went out there frequently to see what, you know, we were doing and how they were planning operations so that I could fit in naval-wise. For instance, they'd say, well, we're going to raid... we went to the Caskets Lighthouse, and I went out to Bear Regis, and we were briefed out there as to what we were going to do, how we were going to deal with it, and what my role was going to be. And I came back, got the boat ready. That meant fueling up, arming the boat, and necessary anchors and things like that. And they'd arrive at about, say, dusk, a particular evening. We had to choose the time of the month when the moon was at the right quarter or sequence. We'd set off from Portsmouth generally for Caskets, drive down through the Solent and across to the Caskets Lighthouse. I was always alone. We were only a small boat. My crew consisted of about eight chaps and a dozen commandos. And we'd get close to the Caskets Lighthouse and idle down into silent engines or reduce speed to a much quieter level, then anchor the boat, quarter, half a mile off the rocks, anchor down and launch the dory, and the commandos would push ashore, and I'd keep bearings to see that we were not drifting so that they could come back, because they'd come back on a reciprocal course, and eventually an hour or 2 hours later they would come back with whatever information they'd gleaned or whatever captives they'd got. And all being well, we'd embark them, put the dory back on board, and sail back for Portsmouth with hopefully none the wiser at that stage. Didn't always work out like that, but that was, for instance, the raid on the Caskets when we brought back, I think it was, five German prisoners.
What impression did the German prisoners make on you?
Well, they were totally... the impression on us, they were elderly chaps. I think they were generally reservist types, five or six, I think. And they manned the lighthouse, which was lit at certain times when German convoys were going through. They were totally surprised by the commandos being present there. This, in fact, was fully recorded in a commando book called A Steel Hand from the Sea, I think it was called. It was a command operations magazine. One or two of the Germans wore hair nets. Incredible. They were sort of somewhat effeminate natured people. They were totally surprised by us anyway, and we got them back on board. They were very subdued, and they were taken off for interrogation when we got back home. But so we left the lighthouse with no bodies at all there. I think they chucked all the any guns that were lying around, or machine guns. I think they chucked those over the side onto the rocks, so they broke up, did a bit of damage, and then they just came away and left the lighthouse untenanted. Of course, the Germans found out when they got a convoy going through, there was no signals coming from the Caskets Lighthouse, so they sent boats out to investigate, and obviously remanned it and resecured it as best they could. But we didn't raid Caskets again. That was just one raid we did.
And they were wearing hair nets, or had they been having perms or something?
No, I don't know about that. I think a couple of them were wearing hair nets. Don't ask me why, but they were. But presumably... just their way of going to bed at night, but they were all asleep. There was nobody on watch. Presumably it was a quiet time, there were no convoys going through, and there was no reason why they should all be up. But they were, as I say, totally surprised when we roused them from their bunks.
Do you know the date of that raid?
Yes.
Did you get to know March Phillips and Abelard very well?
Very well, because, I mean, I was the naval link for them. I was their only means of getting, at least at that stage, their only means of getting to where they wanted to go. My boat was sort of attached to them. I was fully serviced by the Navy, of course, at my Portsmouth base, but any operations were done through Combined Ops, through Appleyard and March Phillips and myself. They were both very, very, very brave men, actually. They both got killed eventually, but while it lasted, it was very quite exciting.
Can you take each of them in turn and tell me what they were like?
March Phillips I knew less of because he was the sort of total commander. He was slightly more aloof, but he was a tall, I think a very well connected person. I think he was in the Royal Artillery, actually, and he, like others, had volunteered for this. In fact, I think he formed the small scale raiding force. And he recruited particular men from some. I think some were his friends that he recruited. Appleyard was one. I think both of those and one or two others had in fact been doing commando work off the west coast of Africa before they joined, before they set up in this country. So they were pretty well known in combined ops circles. And as I say, well, I took 344 over and I was introduced to them, and our liaison continued in that way. Appleyard was his first lieutenant, or his second in command. Again, a university man. I think he came from the Appleyard family in Yorkshire somewhere, the big motor people. I think that was his family. Charming man, again, very brave. He had. Whereas March Phillips had all the dash and flair and the sort of outward going signs of a commando, Appleyard was much more the thinker, and I think, I won't say the brains of the operation, but he gave a great deal more detailed thought to what we were going to do and sort of planned it more, whereas March Phillips set up the sort of inception of the scheme. Then of course we had, there was Graham Hayes. I can't remember the chap's names now. There were three or four others of like ilk, plus, of course, a couple of sergeants and the usual ordinary ranks, all well trained and all been doing commando work anyway. And they got this group together of about, I suppose, in all there'd be about 20 of them, and then they'd pick half a dozen, eight of them, to come on a particular raid at any particular time. But Appleyard and March Phillips always were in command.
Did you know anything personally about the way in which they met their ends?
Oh yes, yes. We did one raid off Port en Bassin, and March Phillips was in command with Appleyard, and it was way down in the Bay of. Well, the bay is the Seine Bay, I think it is, south of Cherbourg, right down in the big bay. It was a long, flat coast. I don't quite know what they were after at this, because it seemed to me slightly an odd place to go. Normally, they would go for a rocky area and work their way up to wherever they wanted to get, to a village or something. Whereas this was a flat, sandy beach, and.
So they used to go to a rocky area because of footprints?
I think it was easier for them to carry out their work, and less easy to be discovered, whereas they were going to land on a flat, long beach. They did land. We anchored offshore about a quarter of a mile. The boat went ashore. They paddled the dory ashore. And unfortunately, at that very moment when their dory was going to land, just coming into the surf, an army German patrol came along on the beach. Our party were challenged. I was in the torpedo boat, and so was Appleyard. Appleyard, incidentally, had broken his leg coming down from Caskets. He'd fell off a rock and injured his leg, so he stayed aboard the MTB on that particular night. But the Germans opened fire to our people who were just getting out of their boat. The fire was returned, and during it all, we got nobody back. They were all captured and killed. I say not all killed, they were all captured. Most of them were killed, including March Phillips. We had to cut the anchor to get away. A bullet went through one of our engines, so that reduced us very badly to only one engine instead of two. And we turned and made out towards the sea. One of the things we were not sure about was whether the Germans would have called up any E-boats from Cherbourg or somewhere like that to intercept us. So we couldn't really hang about. There was no way we could get any of the commandos back. They were either already captured or they were in fact disabled and killed. Later on we understood, I think it was, they in fact captured alive two or three of them. One was Captain Hayes, and he was finally tried, and he was executed. They shot him much later. It was typical German attitude. But March Phillips was killed at the point of landing at some stage or other. Appleyard continued then as the commanding officer of the SSRF, and eventually, I can't remember exactly, we more or less... operations were coming to an end. The whole war scene was changing in this light, these small raids. I think it was basically the sort of forerunner of the invasion of Europe. They got all the information they wanted. I mean, one of the things we used to do was to go over and test the soil to see if tanks could land on a particular beach, that sort of thing. Well, presumably they got all the information they wanted, and the unit was disbanded. And Appleyard went out to the Med, and what we know about Appleyard that he was carrying out a reconnaissance in a plane somewhere in Italy, and the plane was shot down. I don't think they ever found his body, I didn't know that anyway. But he was shot down and presumed missing, and that was the end of Appleyard. So, it was a bit unfortunate. After that, the whole unit packed up, and I went back to ordinary torpedo boats, and everybody else dispersed. But we had Pat Porteous with us for a while, the VC. He was he won his VC at Dieppe. No, not Dieppe. Was it Dieppe?
The Dieppe raid, yes.
That's right. And Andy Lassen, who was the famous Danish commando, he was part of the same group. So they were all, you know, pretty powerful commando types.
What was Larsen like?
Larsen was a very quiet Dane, but he was extremely ruthless. He only came on a couple of raids, I think. He was, after March Phillips was killed, Appleyard, Larsen and Porteous became raid commanders as they felt like it. I mean, Appleyard didn't lead everyone, but Larsen and Porteous would take command.
Do you know the date of the raid on Port on Bassin when March Phillips was lost?
Yes, I'll tell you that. Off the 13th of September 1942.
And I'm not sure that we put on tape the date of the earlier raid on the Caskets, which you said was the 2nd of
September
1942.
Yeah, yes.
And when was the SSRF wound up?
Well, one of the things I've lost in this burglary was a diary, which I kept all my, when I joined ships, when I left ships, and the rest of it, some of which I remembered is on that form, and it included dates like when SSRF packed up, and I can't remember it for the moment, but the last raid which I did was in the 8th of January 1943, So it was some time after then.
What do you remember about that last raid?
Witticism. That was, we went from Portland to St. Peterport to put limpet mines on ships in the harbour.
The name of the operation was...
The name of the operation was Witticism, yes.
And St. Peterport is the port of Guernsey.
Guernsey, that's right, yes.
Can you tell me in detail about it, please?
Well, no, I can't remember that one. I believe they did it. They successfully put limpet mines on ships in Guernsey Harbour, and I can't recall anything other than that. If you want the names of the other two raids, Port on Bassam was Aquatint, and the Caskets was Dryad. They all had these code names.
You've told me that when you were with MTB 344, you completed 17 operations.
That's right.
Which other ones stick out in your mind in most detail?
Well, at some stage, and let me try and think when, it must have been late 42, I found that since I was the only officer on board MTB 344, I had to drive the boat and navigate the boat. Now, Appleyard was a first-class navigator. He was an ex-yachtsman and had sailed, as I said, off West Africa, so he knew a bit about the sea and tides and things. But between us, we said that we ought to have an official navigator, and a Belgian navigator was appointed to 344 on four raids only. A chap called Rick Van Riel. He was an excellent chap. And he navigated... any particular raid we were going on, he would work out the tides and the courses and the speeds, and I would then drive the boat and sort of supervise the boat security, gunnery and that sort of thing. Otherwise I kept having to go down into the below to look at the charts, then come up again and see if the crew were still there and the boat was still functioning. And it was just not on, it didn't work very successfully, so we had this Belgian navigator. And the other raids, which, we visited quite a number of places. One particular one which hit the headlines was a raid on Sark, or Operation Basalt. And that was on the 3rd of April, the 3rd of October, 1942. And we had the Belgian navigator on board for that. And he took us right into the islands into Sark, and we anchored off, I think it's called Point Terrible Point, I think it was, which was either like a sort of big hog's back which went up into the island. We anchored off there and the party went ashore. Now I think Andy Larson was on that raid with Appleyard. Yes, because Marchfords had been killed by then, and Appleyard was in command. And they went up to the village, they clambered up the rocks, went up into the village, and they entered... Incidentally, this is fully detailed in a book about the Channel Islands. It's been already recounted. But they went into a house, and they found an elderly lady, somewhat frightened. They broke in. And she gave them all sorts of details about the state of the people on the islands. I mean, how they were faring under the German regime, what food they had or what food they hadn't, and all things like that. They got a great deal of information from her. And I think they even brought back some of the bread and stuff, which they were to take back to England to show exactly what was going on. I think they also brought back some newspapers which the island were publishing. Anyway, they left her and she pointed out where the island garrison was based, somewhere further up the village. And I'm not too sure now exactly what happened. Anyway, they broke into that, and they, in fact, captured several Germans. There was quite a bit of firing. The Germans were awake by this time. And they captured, I can't remember how many Germans, four or five, I think, again. And they left the village in a hurry to come back to the boat down this tortuous path down to the down the rocky cliff down to the beach. And several of the it may have been one, it may have been several of the German prisoners, they tied their hands incidentally because they had to get them down this rocky escarpment to, and they couldn't do it with the chap's hands free, so they tied their hands and hustled them along, and one or several of them started to shout because the Germans were still in a sort of somewhat dazed up in the village, not knowing quite what was going on. And in order to attract attention, these Germans started to shout and scream. So they, I can't remember whether they shot them or knifed them, but they were found next morning. They had to leave them. They couldn't jeopardise their own position. We brought one or two back onto the boat. They brought one or two back who were more timid than the others. But the remainder, two or three of them, they left dead on the footpath, which the Germans found the next day. We got the chaps back on board all right, and including the Germans, got them back to England, and they went off to interrogation and report to combined headquarters. A day or two later, or a short while later, when the whole episode came to light to the German high command, Hitler personally ordered, since they'd found the Germans with their hands tied and shot or knifed, that the prisoners which had been captured, the Canadian prisoners captured at Dieppe, should be manacled as a result of that raid, and that in future all commandos caught would be immediately shot. There would be no question about prisoner of war status. That was a situation which arose from that particular raid.
When you were doing these operations, what was your plan about waiting to pick up the commandos once they'd finished their job? Presumably there was a certain amount of discretion on your part as to how long you would wait.
Well, they reckoned a time limit ashore would be whatever it was, taking into consideration all the eventualities. If in fact they, like Port-en-Bassin, they were all caught ashore, it was left entirely to me, and in fact to Appuyard at that stage, since he was on board, as to what we would do. And as I was in command of the boat and the safety of my crew, there was not much I could do except get out of it, and it would be the same on any other situation. The thing that one had to be aware of was that there were flotillas of E-boats in various ports around the French coast who could be alerted and intercept me at any stage, and we had to sort of cut and run as quickly as possible. We wouldn't have left anybody in the lurch if anybody, in fact one or two chaps I think tried to swim out at Port-en-Bassin. We heard them in the water, but they were too far off for us to do anything, and by that time we got a searchlight on us, and we couldn't rescue them. And the same would go for any other situation.
Were you ever intercepted by E-boats or aeroplanes?
No, no. We were on one occasion off Cherbourg. We ran into a German patrol, and they picked us up on their radar and fired at us. So we had to abort the operation. We weren't offensive in the terms that we would open fire. We weren't equipped for that. We hadn't got the sufficient gunpowder for that sort of thing. Ours was a sort of clandestine affair, and there was no point in jeopardising a future operation by trying to be brave about it. So we quietly turned round and headed for home and aborted the operation. But we were never intercepted.